All right. Well, it's always wonderful to be back at the KATP, one of my fondest intellectual homes away from home. And I have to say, indeed, there's a rapid response workshop going on future accelerators. And it's a little surreal to be having this discussion about accelerators that might be coming online in 10, 20, 30 years. Because it's obvious that the future of accelerator physics is right now. I mean, this month, this year, with the running of the LHC. And while all of us gathered here are pondering imponderables of what might happen on the timescale of decades, we're also all waiting with bated breath just for the next few weeks to hear the fate of various interesting anomalies that have shown up. And if not that, than anything else that might show up in the next few months, because this is by far the most exciting and important discovery phase of the running of the LHC. This year, really the next couple of years, are going to essentially tell us which way the future is going to break, at least as far as the LHC physics is concerned, whether it's going to be filled with a huge number of things to explain, or if we're going to have to work much, much harder in order to try to dig out anything that there may or may not be in the data. So with that being said, the reason for thinking about these things now is that, as probably most of you know, even if you aren't particle physicists, the thinking about and planning for big accelerators is a multi-decade long project. The LHC was a twinkle in some people's eyes in the 1980s, and it got going towards the end of the 2000s. So if we want to think about what the future of the field is, this is really a very good time to be thinking about it. This is a very large topic to tell you about all the possible accelerators that people have been thinking about. Most notably, over the past 15 years, there's been a big, very solid, very good push for building an accelerator after the LHC, an international linear collider, colliding electrons and positrons in Japan. Since that's relatively more familiar, I'm going to spend less time talking about it. Today, I'll mostly talk about the sort of new kids on the block in the past couple of years, which are the idea that we might have a next generation big circular tunnel somewhere on the planet, perhaps around 50, 70, maybe 100 kilometers around, that could collide both electrons and positrons potentially in an early phase, collide electrons and positrons producing millions of Higgs particles, and in another phase it could also collide protons, potentially getting to energies of order 100 TeV, which is over 7 times the energy that we have at the LHC. So what I'd like to do is mostly talk about the motivations for this program, and then at the end make some other comments about some of the other accelerators and sort of more general comments about where we stand. So now, a very zeroth order thing before we talk about motivations for big colliders, it goes without saying that the biggest motivation for any large-scale scientific project like this is the pure damn curiosity of pushing the frontier, right? So this is the short-distance frontier, and human beings have been chasing various aspects of fundamental physics for 2,000 years or 400 years, depending on when you start counting. But this particular way of thinking about fundamental physics, using higher and higher energy probes going to shorter and shorter distances, really started over 100 years ago with Rutherford, and really took on a lot more clout in driving fundamental physics in the 1940s, 50s, and afterwards. So we've been at it for half a century now. And we've arrived at a point in our understanding of fundamental physics where where it's it isn't just a luxury, or it's not like more or less we know exactly what's going to happen, so we can sort of stop now, or it's so complicated that it's peeling back yet another layer of the onion over and over again to expose more and more structure, we've arrived at a set of questions that are really of a qualitatively different character than questions that we've asked 40, 50 years ago. And these questions are dramatic. They go to the heart of our understanding of space-time and quantum mechanics. And figuring out what these mysteries are, what they're trying to tell us about nature, absolutely forces us to take a step beyond the steps that we've had with the LHC so far. And so that's what it is that I want to tell you about. But before getting started, if you know something about particle physics, you might know that the LHC was probing a very well-known energy scale, the scale of the weak interactions. And we've known about that scale since Fermi. And there are very good arguments, even before the LHC started, that if we just took the particles that had been seen, and in the description they're given in the standard model of particle physics, but if we just took the particles that were seen and nothing else, that theory predicted its own demise. It had its own internal inconsistency, and it predicted its own breakdown at energies beneath around 4 pi times the mass of the W boson, or something like 1,000 GeV or so. And so we knew that something new had to come in. Some new dynamic, some new particle, something had to come in. In the simplest possible picture of the standard model of particle physics, that something is the Higgs particle. But even independent of that, in a rather model-independent way, we knew that something had to come in. And indeed it did. So we ran the LHC, we saw the Higgs, and that completes one part of our journey of our understanding the mechanics of how the elementary particles interact with each other. Now, for the rest of this talk, I'm going to assume that the year is 2020. Okay, we finished the second run of the LHC. We're digesting it, and we haven't seen any evidence for new particles beyond the Higgs. I'm doing that. That may change in 2 weeks. Okay, it may change in 3 weeks. But I'm doing that because, as I'll try to explain a little bit more detail later, the case for doing this rather obviously only gets better if we see particles beyond what we've seen. So that's why what I want to do, not because I necessarily believe that's the way things are going to shake out, although I think there's a non-trivial possibility that that's the way things will shake out anyway. But I'm going to assume that all we're seeing is the Higgs and nothing else. And after discovering the Higgs, indeed, famously, we're in possession of a theoretical framework that does not predict its own demise, unlike what we had before. In fact, we can consistently extrapolate it to energies of order the Planck scale. That's eventually, it predicts its own demise when gravity becomes important and all sorts of hell breaks loose. But that scale is 16 orders of magnitude higher than anything we're ever going to probe in anyone's lifetime. So for all practical purposes, we have a theoretical structure that does not predict its own demise. And so we can't guarantee that if we build another accelerator, we're going to discover new particles. That's something that we could guarantee for the LHC. It's something that we cannot guarantee with the next generation of big accelerators. So right here is a first bifurcation in whether you're going to find this project intellectually exciting or not. What is the definition of what it is that we're after in particle physics? Indeed, is what we're after discovering new particles, as you might be led to believe from the name of the subject. If you think that the purpose of particle physics is discovering the ultimate building blocks of matter, and therefore, as you go to shorter and shorter distances, discovering more and more elementary particles that things are made of, if you like these Russian doll pictures going all the way down to arbitrarily tiny distances, and you like this picture that we're just peeling back one layer of an onion, one after the other, discovering more and more structure as you go down, then we cannot guarantee that that's going to happen. Okay? That was a picture for what a great period of discovery in particle physics looked like in the 1960s. But things are very different today, and we absolutely cannot guarantee that that will happen. However, that's not what, certainly not why I'm interested in particle physics. And I think the vast majority of us who are in this field don't actually care about the particles all that much. Okay? We're interested in the particles because the particles tell us a story about the fundamental laws. And we've learned over the period of 100 years that that in order to best understand what those laws are, we have to go to very, very high energies, very short distances, where their essential character is revealed without being obstructed by long-distance accidents that we have to plow through in order to see what the physics really wants to look like in its purest, most unadulterated form. So particle physics is not merely, I mean, that's part of it, is the study of the building blocks of matter. But it's not merely studying the building blocks of matter. What we really care about is the study of the fundamental laws of nature, and in particular, where the subject, where H bar and C are both important at the same time, we're interested in the fundamental laws of nature that are governed by the as yet still mysterious union of special relativity and quantum mechanics. And we understand this union of these two subjects well enough to be able to do things like predict the G minus 2 of the electron to 12 decimal places. But there are other aspects of this very basic union of space-time and quantum mechanics that are deeply, deeply mysterious. And where the discoveries at the LHC, especially if we see the Higgs particle and nothing else, only deepen and add to this mystery, and where we'll really need this next generation of accelerator in order to learn more about. So I would say that new physics does not necessarily mean new particles. What we really care about are new principles, new phenomenon and new principles. If that's what we really care about, which is what the vast majority of us care about, then the point that we've arrived at in the development of our field is actually ripe for some important either major addition to an existing paradigm or entire change of an existing paradigm. And the reason is that the Higgs particle that we discovered is really new physics. And this isn't hype, okay? So I'm going to try to explain why the precise sense in which this is true. In fact, we've never seen something like the Higgs particle before. In no other part of physics, the basic structure of quantum field theory, minus the relativity part, can actually be concocted up in lots and lots of lab systems. So our condensed matter colleagues really enjoy building beautiful systems that are described at long distances by lots of fascinating and interesting quantum field theories, effective quantum field theories. In these effective quantum field theories, they've seen phenomenon that include almost all the aspects that we've seen in the standard model of particle physics. So they get things that look like chiral fermions. They get things that look like gauge fields, emergent gauge fields. So these are the pieces of the standard model that we'd seen before we'd seen the Higgs. But they've never seen something like the Higgs. Okay, they've never seen something like the Higgs unless they do rather insane adjustments of the parameters of their system in order to artificially engineer it. Whereas the other things, once you find the right kind of material, as a robust feature, you get out things that look like chiral fermions, things that look like emergent gauge fields. So why is that? What's special about the Higgs? Well, it all has to do with the fact that it's sort of paradoxical, because the Higgs is the simplest elementary particle we've ever seen. Every other elementary particle has some other bells and whistles that go along with it other than just its mass. You take the electron, it has a mass, it has a spin, it has a charge. Okay? Every other particle has some other quantum number. The Higgs has nothing. Okay? It's just totally, all it has is its mass and nothing else. And it's that very simplicity that makes its existence so mysterious. The paradox about the Higgs is that, on the one hand, people say that it was predicted 50 years ago. And indeed, if you try to write down the very simplest theories that could accommodate massive W and Z particles, the very dumbest things that you would do would invoke something like the Higgs. But then more sophisticated quantum field theorists who looked at this said, look, that's very strange. We shouldn't just see something like the Higgs. We should see elsewhere that we've seen it in nature. We haven't seen anything so simple. Okay? And as you'll see in a second, It's this very simplicity that would naively make its existence impossible. So that's the paradox about the Higgs. It's incredibly simple, but its simplicity makes its existence seemingly impossible. Let me give two illustrations of why this is the case. The first one is to do something really simple and imagine that we're looking at just the energy in a box. Okay, we're going to take a box of vacuum, okay, side length L, and I'm going to take the total energy in the box, but I have various, for example, here are particle in a box modes for various elementary particles. Let's say the W particle or the Z particle, maybe the top quark. Well, the energy is a sum over all the modes, the vacuum energy. I'm going to look at the energy in the vacuum. It's sum over the modes of a half h bar times omega. Okay, the omega for all these modes. I can label them by some vector of integers n. Well, in fact, it's the half h bar omega for all the bosons and minus the half h bar omega for all the fermions. Okay, so as usual, I can actually convert this to the volume of the box times an integral over spatial momenta of a half h bar, and the omega is root k squared plus m squared of the bosons minus root k squared plus m squared of the fermions. Okay, so that's the energy in a box. So the energy per unit volume, which is also often called the cosmological constant, the vacuum energy density, is given by this integral b cubed k, a half. We'll work in units with h bar as 1, so we have root k squared plus m squared boson minus root k squared plus m squared fermion. And so, now, I need to tell you one other small thing, which is that the mass of particles like the top is given by some coupling constant times whatever the value the Higgs field takes throughout space and time. Okay? And the mass of particles like the W is also given by some other coupling constant times the same thing. Now here it's very important that this value that the Higgs field can take that's uniform in all of space and time is possible. Okay? If I tried to put something there, for example, for the photon field or the W and the Z field, I couldn't do that because that's something that would necessarily pick out a direction in space. It would break the Lorentz invariance of that we see in the real world. But a very special property of the Higgs, because it has spin zero, that's the critical thing. Because the Higgs has spin zero, it is allowed to have a constant value like this throughout space and time without picking out a preferred frame. Okay, so let's put this into this formula. So we have a d cubed k, a half root k squared, plus some constant here, let's say g squared times the value of the Higgs, and then minus a root k squared plus some lambda squared times the value of the Higgs. And this formula, this little dumb formula, has two of the major crises in theoretical physics in it. Okay? Because let's just compute this integral. See, as I go to very large k, I can ignore these little masses, and the integrand here goes like magnitude of k. So I have d cubed k times magnitude of k. So this energy of the vacuum has one piece that goes like k max to the fourth. If I cut off this integral at some large k max, but underneath it, if I expand the square roots, then there'll be a piece that goes like k max squared times some g squared, a squared, minus lambda squared, h squared, something like that, plus dot, dot, dot. Okay? And so we see that just adding up the half h bar omega for all the particle in a box modes gives us an enormous energy density of the vacuum. That k max is just to whatever distance scale I think that I can think about drawing this picture of a box, well, that's the k up to which I should be able to make this estimate. And this K-max is certainly of order, at least the scale of a hundred of GeV or a TeV, where we probe things at colliders. Theoretically, it could go all the way up to the Planck scale. Similarly here. Okay? So this thing should give us an enormous energy density of the vacuum. And on top of that, the dependence of the energy density on the value of the Higgs should mean that if I make the Higgs depart from the value that it's supposed to have, it costs a lot of energy. So that means that the Higgs should be incredibly massive. And you should get an estimate for the mass of the Higgs. It's simply given by roughly K max times these numbers that are of order one. This is a very, very well-known standard estimate, but I'm presenting it in this way just to make it clear that these two problems are just a Taylor expansion of one and the same thing. Okay, just the energy density of the vacuum is vastly too large. This thing should curve the universe. This is the cosmological constant problem. So if we put the K-max even at 100 GeV, it should curve the universe at the scale of a millimeter. And yet it's not curved, or it is curved, but at the scale of 10 billion light years. And if K-max is a scale much, much above the hundreds of GeV scale, then the Higgs should be very, very massive. Okay. So it's a qualitative problem. Why is there a macroscopic universe? Why is there a macroscopic universe when there are violent quantum mechanical fluctuations that are more and more violent at shorter and shorter distances that would naively destroy the possibility of having any long-range order? Okay, so that's the question. And I'm also presenting it this way to make it clear how tightly it's linked to the basic structure of quantum mechanics in space-time. Right? So, okay. So that's one reason people either expected that there would be no Higgs, so you couldn't run this argument, or if there was a Higgs, it should come along with a ton of other particles. This K-max shouldn't be too much larger than a few hundred GeV. Then at least it would make sense that the Higgs is where it is. And so either you shouldn't see a Higgs, or if you're going to see a Higgs, it should come along with lots and lots of other particles. And by the way, never mind that even if it did, you would be left with this enormous problem that we still haven't solved. Okay? All right. Now, this problem hits us because the Higgs has spin zero. Let me phrase it another way that makes the spin of the Higgs, that highlights the importance of the spin of the Higgs. Let's go back to the question of why it is that our friends in condensed matter physics manage to find systems where they get chiral fermions or they get emergent gauge fields. Why is it not a problem that we have particles like massless photons? Why are we getting excited about the mass of the Higgs? Why doesn't it bother us that the photon is massless? Yes.
So would you say if there was a landscape in which lambda varied, right, then maybe most universes have a very high value of lambda, but in the ones that are small, where it's small, so we can form galaxies?
Yes.
The Higgs boson mass would be small?
Not necessarily. It depends on your landscape. So it's very, very easy to imagine landscapes. Purely from the top down, if we put in no input about what the world looks like, it's trivial to imagine landscapes that fine-tune for a small cosmological constant, but don't get you a light Higgs. In fact, that's
thanks. That's the answer. Sir.
Yeah. Okay. Why is it that photons can be? Why is it that we're not worried about the masslessness of photons? So you might imagine that in some approximation you have a massless photon. Let's say you have a free massless photon, but then it starts interacting with virtual particles, virtual electrons and positrons and all kinds of other things. Okay, so why don't we worry about the fact that these interactions, these violent quantum fluctuations, why don't they give the photon an enormous mass? Okay. Well, the reason why the photon doesn't have an enormous mass is a very simple counting thing. It's that 2 is not equal to 3. You don't have to draw any diagrams. You don't need to know anything about quantum field theory or any detailed arguments. There's a deep difference between massless and massive particles with spin. Massless particles, a massive spin 1 particle has 3 polarizations. It has 3 polarizations because no matter how fast it's moving, you can always go to a frame where it's at rest. And if its spin is this way, by tilting your head, you can see that it can point in 3 possible directions. So it has 3 degrees of freedom. But a massless spin 1 particle has only 2 degrees of freedom. OK, Okay? It only has helicity. And you're familiar with the fact that photons just have two polarizations, because you can't run that argument, because you can never catch up with it. So it's a discontinuous difference between massless and massive when particles have spin. And that's why you can make the photon interact with anything it wants, but we're not going to change the fact that the photon is massless, because you can't continuously change 2 to 3 degrees of freedom. And essentially, identical argument applies also for fermions. So when you have these other quantum numbers, they make it possible for the existence of the particles to be robust. And that's why, as I said, while you might have to hunt around for the right kind of material to give you an emergent photon, if you can then move things around, you can change continuously the parameters of the situation, you will not change the fact that there is a massless photon. This argument is not true for the Higgs. Okay? It's not true for the Higgs because the Higgs has spin zero. Okay? And here is its most famous interaction that it can have with a top quark. That's the particle that has the biggest interaction with. And that thing has absolutely no reason not to give it an enormous mass, because 1 is equal to 1. Okay? So we don't have a good understanding. We don't have a good reason why the Higgs should be around. Okay? It's totally different than anything we've seen before. That's why I think, you know, 70% of very sophisticated quantum field theorists before the late 1980s and early 1990s would say, no, there's not going to be anything like a Higgs. If you're a conservative, if you think that physics sort of repeats itself and the themes repeat themselves and it's like superconductivity and it's like other things we've seen before, then you would not have predicted that you see something like the Higgs. It's very strange that we see something like the Higgs. We've never seen anything like it before. And this is why. This is why we've never seen anything like it before, because there's no good reason why this particle should be around. We don't have the same basic degrees of freedom counting reasons why the existence of a light Higgs is a sensible thing. Okay, so all of this is to then reinforce from either one of these points of view. This point of view makes it clear that the lightness of the Higgs is very closely related to, in fact, it's a close cousin of the deep mystery about the cosmological constant. Okay? And this is, from a more particle physics perspective, emphasizing why the fact that we have an elementary, point-like, spin-zero particle is so strange. Why if you see it, you shouldn't just shrug your shoulders and walk away, because we've never seen anything like it before. And in fact, if you take the most basic things you would expect from the structure of a quantum field theory, while it's not, it's certainly not impossible to have it, it's very unexpected and peculiar to have it. So from that point of view, I'll say again that the Higgs is really new physics. And so the dominant motivations, apart from, of course, exploring, going to the frontier, seeing what's there, we've done it for centuries, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Apart from all of that, the dominant concrete motivation for building these next machines, which suffices, as far as I'm concerned, and as far as I think most of us who are thinking about this and pushing this are concerned, easily suffices, even if we don't discover any new particles other than the Higgs, is that we've seen this bizarre new particle. We have to put it under a microscope and see what it actually looks like. Okay. So the Higgs is really new physics. We've never seen anything like it before, so we'd like to study it and see if and see what it actually looks like. And so what we'd like to do is to put the Higgs under a microscope. Now, let me be more precise. Because the LHC has already produced, the LHC has produced millions of Higgs particles. Around 1/1000th of those Higgs particles are useful. Okay, so we're going to be talking about a Higgs factory in a moment, something that's going to produce millions of Higgs particles. The LHC is already producing millions of Higgs particles, but unfortunately, in the environment where you collide protons, protons are big, messy objects. Okay, and when you collide them, big, messy things come out. And even if you produce millions of Higgses, the vast majority of the time, they decay in a way that's very difficult to pick out over completely ordinary standard model backgrounds. That's why the way the Higgs was discovered was that you had to wait for the 0.1% of the time that when you make Higgses, it decays into a pair of photons. And that's something that's clean enough that still with a lot of work, you can dig it out of the background. Still, even though it was going to a pair of photons 0.1% of the time, ordinary processes were still making photons at a rate 50 times larger than what you got from a Higgs decays. But that was good enough because when the Higgs decays to two photons, roughly speaking, the energy, the sum of the energies of the photons, or more precisely, if you sum the four momenta of the photons and you square it, it should peak in the neighborhood of the Higgs mass. That was enough of a handle to be able to discover it. So we've made thousands of useful Higgses at the LHC. And we're going to make more. But this is the picture of the Higgs that we're roughly going to get. Okay, so the most burning question about the Higgs is it really an elementary spin zero particle? Now, this word elementary sounds like a fishy word, and it is a fishy word. Okay? In fact, there's no hard and fast invariant distinction between elementary and composite. Okay? But there is a practical and pragmatic and very important distinction between elementary and composite, which is if you have a particle that has some mass m, then does it have structure on a scale comparable to 1 over m? Okay? So if you probe it, if you look at it from the outside, does it look like a point on the scale 1 over m, or does it still look point-like on the scale 1 over m? So two examples. The electron definitely looks point-like on the scale of 1 over 511 keV. In fact, it looks point-like on the scale 1 over 1,000 GeV, which is what we've probed experimentally so far. It's damn point-like. Maybe when we get up to the Planck scale, we see that everything's made out of strings or some other stuff, but it doesn't change the fact that there's a huge range of energies where it's effectively a point-like object. By contrast, even before people did experiments in the 1950s that discovered that the proton had structure on the scale of around 1 over a GeV, which is 10 to the minus 14 centimeters, in fact, we knew that it had to have structure on the scale of 10 to the minus 14 centimeters. For example, the G factor of the proton was not what you would predict from a point-like particle. It was off by it by order one. Okay. So the proton is a classic example of a composite object. Okay. Its size, as measured by how it's looked at from the outside, is comparable to its natural Compton wavelength, 1 over m. The electron and quarks and all the other elementary particles of the standard model are, by contrast, incredibly point-like on the scale associated with their natural mass. And now we get to ask the question, what about the Higgs? Because the entire drama about the Higgs, everything that I told you, everything that suggested that no elementary spin zero particle should be seen, was assuming that it had a point-like structure on the scale of its mass. Okay. So it's an experimental question. How point-like does it look? And roughly speaking, this is the picture that we're going to get from it from the LHC. Okay. So the mass of the Higgs is around 1 over 125 GeV. And so it's already looking somewhat elementary. I'm exaggerating a little. It's going to be a little better than that. But roughly speaking, we're going to see that this is around 1 over 700, 800 GeV or so. Okay? And how do we do that? Well, you know, in the case of looking at protons, you look at it literally with light, right? You see how it interacts with light. In the case of the Higgs, it's rather similar. You see how the Higgs interacts with other particles. Okay, for example, the Higgs decays to 2 gamma. So because it's not a stable particle, we don't have the luxury of just keeping it there and banging something into it, but we do what gives us exactly the same information, which is see how it decays into 2 photons. So that's the closest we can come to looking at it in an almost literal sense. But it decays to other particles too, it decays to Z particles and so on. Okay, so by looking at how it interacts with other particles, we'll get some notion of how point-like it looks. And that's roughly the picture that we're going to get, even if you finish running the LHC till you're blue in the face. Okay, it will start looking more point-like than its scale, than its natural scale, but not by a huge factor. Okay, and this is actually, I think, This is a relevant comparison that can be made is with another particle that might not be familiar to you if you're not a particle physicist, but as one of our most important particles after the very familiar ones, is the pion. The pion, there's a neutral pion. The neutral pion is an object which is certainly elementary on the scale of its mass, okay, at least to roughly this extent. Okay, so here's the Higgs. Here's a pion. And in the case of the pion, its mass is around 130 MeV. And this size, this relevant size, is roughly the scale 1 over 770 MeV, which is roughly the Compton wavelength of the Rho meson. Okay. So, and indeed, and there are many ways of inferring that, but very similar things as to how it interacts with external probes. Okay. So, in other words, now, today we know that the pion is not elementary, and it's actually at the scale of 770 MeV and a little bit higher, we see that it's made out of quarks and antiquarks, and so on. That greatly removes any massive drama associated with it, okay? Because the underlying degrees of freedom that make it up are those particles with spin. Those particles with spin are okay, they're cool, we have no problem with them, okay? So if you resolve and you see that your spin zero particle is made up out of particles with spin, you don't have any difficulty. So the story we're going to have with the Higgs from the LHC is going to be roughly the same as the story we had with the pion in QCD, okay? So that means that it's relatively elementary, but we will not know whether it is more elementary than that, if it's going into really new territory, qualitatively new territory compared to what we've seen before, or not. Okay, so that's the first thing that we'd like to do. We'd like to see how point-like is the Higgs. And as a very concrete benchmark, we'd like to ask, is it 10 times more point-like than the pion? Okay, just can we just really solidly, not just around the same or not, can we just go a factor of 10 higher in energy and see whether it looks like that or it looks like something else? Okay. So what we'd like to do is, first of all, just as far as external probes are concerned, really take it to a picture that looks like this, okay? Instead of that. Increase by a factor of 10 or 20 the resolution with which we see how point-like it is, at least as far as other probes are concerned. Okay? So this is how point-like is it to external probes. Like gammas or z's and other things. Okay, so in order to answer this question, one thing that will definitely answer this question is a Higgs factory. And it'll do a number of other things, but for sure it will settle whether the Higgs is point-like, kind of like the pion is, in which case it's not so dramatic. I mean, of course, then we'd be phenomenal. If we see evidence that it is actually composite on the scale, then there's two decades of fun to be had to figure out what exactly that dynamics is, what it's made of, all of that stuff, right? So that would, oh, that, so there's a, or we see that it isn't, okay? And this is the scenario which is normally talked about as the dread, terrible thing. What if you see that it just continues to look like the Higgs, the boring old Higgs that we've talked about for 50 years already? Well, only when we've confirmed that it does that experimentally do we know for an experimental fact that as theorists we're in wild new territory that we've never been in before, and we have to radically change something in the way we think about the basic structure of quantum field theory. Okay.
Is there any theoretical guidance or expectation?
Yes, there has been theoretical guidance and expectation. There's been theoretical, I'll come back to this in a little bit, but there's been theoretical guidance and expectation for decades for what should happen if we have something like a point like Higgs that comes along with lots of other physics, okay? Which in one way or another gives it a reasonable composite in this size. In fact, trying to copy this idea is one class of ideas of this form, where you make the Higgs itself composite. There are more radical ideas where you make space-time composite at that scale. Okay? So the best version of this idea is supersymmetry, where you see that everything, when you go to scales of around 1 over 700 GeV or 1 over 1,000 GeV, everything has extra structure, not just the Higgs. Okay? In that case, the extra structure is some extra quantum directions to a space-time. Those are arguments that people have had for decades. And there are arguments that that strongly suggested we should see some new physics at the LHC. Now that still might happen, but it's the 11th hour for it to happen. Okay, so that's something that might be decided on the scale of weeks or months or the next couple of years. But what I want to stress is that either answer to this question is radical. Okay, either we discover some. You see, what this new physics does has got to be. It can't just be some random particle or two, right? It has a job to do. It has to explain why we have this Higgs sitting around. Okay, and so it has a very constrained structure. Just to give some beef, just to put some meat on that claim. In the 30 years that people thought about this problem, it's not like theorists woke up out of bed every week and they said, oh, here's another idea for solving it, here's another idea, here's another idea. Many of the other mysteries we have for going beyond the Standard Model have that character. They're very easy to solve. These problems have not been easy to solve. And in the 30 years people thought about them, they, roughly speaking, had two kinds of ideas for how to solve them. Okay? The problem with the cosmological constant is even harder. They've had zero ideas for how to solve them. Except invoking not a change in our picture of space-time at very tiny distances, but at enormous distances with something like eternal inflation and the multiverse, which might also conceivably have something to do with this problem as well. Okay. But, maybe I can come back to that point. I can come back to that point at the end. But what I want to say is that either it's something like people expected for 30 years, and it's already it's the 11th hour for it. It might show up. And I'll come back to that in a second. Because even if that shows up at the LHC next few weeks, this month, this year, next 3 years, the fact that it hasn't shown up already means that we're not going to make millions of these particles. See, the picture that people had when I was a graduate student was that the LHC would turn on and there would be millions of superparticles coming out. I mean, people use the language of having more signal than background. So the signal will be its own background, okay? And this was not a joke. This was not a joke, because that by all rights is what should have happened. That's not the world that we're in. Doesn't mean that it's wrong. It doesn't mean, again, it could still show up. But even if it shows up, we're not making millions of them. We're making thousands of them, if we're lucky. And since it's thousands of them, that's not enough to be able to learn the lesson it's trying to tell us about the TeV scale. Okay? So even if you have new states, you're going to need to build the next accelerator to see what else is out there, because you're very unlikely to see the whole spectrum, given that it's been delayed so far. And even the states that you do see, to make them in millions, so you can study their properties, not in hyper detail, but even to get some robust zeroth order picture for what's going on.
Another motivation that people often bring up is the existence of dark matter and its.
Yes, I'm coming to that in a second. Yes, I'm coming to that in a second. What I'm leading with here is these stories about the Higgs, because this is what's absolutely guaranteed to be done by Higgs Factory and 100 TeV Collider. And as I say, to my mind and to the mind of, I think, most of us who are excited about this program, this together with the zeroth order we're exploring, this is solid. This is great. This is guaranteed physics that will be done by these machines. And it's not about some random detail, something, fourth decimal place. We know already what's going on. There's drama associated with this question. And so we need to know the answer. Okay. So that's... Okay, so one question is how point-like it looks to external probes. There's another fascinating question, which is... let me draw sort of Higgs coming along here, actually, and decaying to a pair of particles. There's another interesting question, which is, does the Higgs look point-like to itself? Okay. And now, this interaction between three elementary particles, you might think this is the most basic, elementary, fundamental interaction that you could imagine having in any theory, right? You can't have an interaction between, if you have one thing turning into another thing, just two particles, you would just change the basis and just redefine what you mean by the particle. So the most fundamental interaction you can have is three things coming together at a point in space-time. But you can ask, have we seen that anywhere in physics before? And the answer is no. There's no particle that can enjoy a self-interaction like that, other than a particle that has no properties, no charge, no spin. The only thing that can do it is the Higgs. You might say, what about particles like gluons? Okay, well, gluons change their color when they interact with each other. Okay, what about W's? They change their weak flavor when they interact with each other. What about gravitons? They change their helicity when they interact with each other. Okay, every other elementary particle changes something. We've never seen this most basic interaction possible in nature, because the only thing that can have it is an elementary spin zero particle. So that's a fantastic probe of whether it's elementary. In fact, it's the strongest probe of whether it's elementary, whether it looks elementary to itself, in addition to looking elementary to other particles. Now, what will we know from the LHC about whether this interaction even exists? We'll have barely evidence that it exists, never mind measure what it is. Okay. We'll know what it is at roughly the 50% level. Okay. So you could legitimately, even after the LHC, put a question mark about whether this interaction even exists. Okay. In order to see whether the interaction is there, you need to produce tens of billions of Higgs particles. Okay. So many of them that not only producing single Higgses, but producing double Higgses through the presence of this interaction becomes visible. And that's what going to 100 TeV proton-proton collider, in addition to going to the energy frontier and seeing what's there and all the rest of it, the thing that it'll allow us to do is see whether this most basic elementary interaction possible in nature is actually there and whether the Higgs has it. And the 100 TeV collider will not only confirm that this coupling is there, but will measure it at around the 5% or maybe better level. All right. So I think that, to me, is the completely guaranteed experimental program of a Higgs factory. Now, here, in order to do this, you want to produce millions of Higgs particles in a very clean environment so that you can study every single one of them that you made and see how they decay. So for that, it's ideal to collide electrons and positrons. Thankfully, the mass of the Higgs being at around 125 GeV, had the Higgs been like 180, this would have been, in a circular machine, this would have been more difficult. But when it's around 125 GeV, it turns out that you need to collide them with a center of mass energy around 250 GeV. That's not 2 times mh, by the way. That's really the mass of the Higgs plus the mass of the Z particle. But anyway, it turns out that the peak cross-section for producing Higgs is at around 125 GeV is when the center of mass energy is in the neighborhood of 240 GeV. Okay? And that's a thankful good thing, because had it been much higher, even 100 GeV higher, then the amount of then it becomes harder and harder to accelerate electrons and positrons without giving off too much energy in synchrotron radiation. Okay, so this is a nice sweet spot where you can actually where you can accelerate them, collide them, produce millions of them, and study the Higgs particle and study these couplings with an accuracy 10 to 30 times what you can get at the LHC. Okay. At 100 TeV collider, as I just said, we can produce tens of billions of Higgs particles and actually see that the Higgs looks point-like to itself at the 5% level. Okay. But let me now mention a number of other motivations, and I don't have too much time, so I'll just sketch them. So an important question. So you see, since we're not guaranteed, since we don't know where new particles are in this scenario, it is important to convince yourself that you need to go to 100 TeV and not 1,000 TeV, or that you need to make millions of Higgs particles and not hundreds of millions of Higgs particles, right? So that's, but there is a reasonable benchmark there. You want to see whether things look 10 times more point-like than the Apion. Okay, that order of magnitude is a completely reasonable, is a totally reasonable benchmark. And for that, you don't need hundreds of millions of Higgses, you need millions of Higgses. So that's great for a Higgs factory. You want to see that this three-point interaction is there. You don't care to measure it to 0.001% accuracy. You just want to see, does it look point-like at some zeroth order? First order beyond it, for that you need 100 TeV, not 1,000 TeV. Okay? So that means that these next steps that we're talking about are appropriate for these zeroth order physics questions. None of this should be very surprising, by the way. As David Gross has often emphasized in talking about this business, if you really want to understand physics at a scale E, you don't do experiments right around the scale E. You go to 10E, right? You go to 10E in order to really be confident and get a clean, good understanding for what's going on. That's what we're talking about here. The LHC was a facility that made Higgses gloriously, wonderfully. We could discover it. But you need another order of magnitude to really see what's going on with this object. And as I've stressed 100 times now, it's important to do because it's a strange object. It's not a garden variety thing, the likes of which we've seen 50 times before. We haven't seen anything like it before. Okay, but what I want to now talk about are, or at least sketch, three other broad classes of questions which are have an invariant independent importance, and where these are the machines which will tell us something robustly about them. Okay, so the three questions are, on the one hand, the nature of the electroweak phase transition. The question of naturalness. And finally, weakly interacting dark matter. Okay, so let me just say a few words about these things. So this question is closely related to some of the ones that I've talked about already. We spent decades in particle physics wondering how electroweak symmetry broke, and it's a very natural question: how is it restored? How is it restored as you go to very high energies? How is it restored as you go to very high temperatures? Okay, these are two obvious questions. Now, one of the beautiful things that a 100 TeV collider does, forgetting about anything else, is it actually finally probes what the standard model looks like in a regime where all the particles look effectively massless. Okay? Even at the LHC, when you produce particles like Ws and top quarks and things like that, you might think that, well, the energies of the LHC are much higher than the mass of the top quark, right? The mass of the top quark is 175 GeV. The energies of the LHC are 10 times that. So the top quarks are whizzing out at an enormous speed. Well, no, because the rate for producing them is really dominated for fairly slow top quarks coming out. Okay? We actually haven't seen, and we're not likely to see, we might barely start seeing it, but we're not likely to see what the standard model looks like when all the particles look effectively massless. Okay, so that's seeing how electroweak symmetry is restored as we go to higher energy directly is something that we can do experimentally, but we don't see it at the LHC. But a factor of 10 higher, going to 100 TeV, you start in a qualitative way, you start seeing it. Let me just give you one example of something that just starts happening, okay? Just starts happening in an interesting way. We normally think of particles like neutrinos as being invisible, right? But not if you had incredibly high energies, they're not. You see, if you have incredibly high energies and W particles are effectively as massless as photons are, then neutrinos radiate Ws, just like charged particles radiate photons, okay? And so, if we got to really parametrically high energies, neutrinos wouldn't be invisible. If you emitted a neutrino, well, it would radiate Ws just like ordinary charged particles radiate photons. That phenomenon of getting to see neutrinos a big fraction of the time because they radiate a lot of W's is something that definitely doesn't happen at the LHC, but starts happening in 100 TeV collisions. There the energies get high enough compared to the weak scale that it actually happens in non-negligible amount of time when you have energetic processes with energy much larger than the weak scale. It's, you know, 5, 10 TeV or so. Okay, so just going to 100 TeV collisions tells us something about, just allows us to probe what the standard model looks like when it starts looking effectively massless. We can see the fundamental unification between all the interactions, the fact that they're described in exactly the same gauge theory language. Of course, it's hardwired into our description of the standard model, but we'll get to see it and explore it experimentally. That's a beautiful and exciting thing. Another question is, as we go to very high temperatures in the early universe, what did the phase transition look like? In the standard model, it's a smooth phase transition. Okay? But it's conceivable that there are other particles out there that interact with the Higgs, and they change the nature of the phase transition. In fact, everything that we know about the Higgs by the end of the running of the LHC could be perfectly compatible with having extra particles around that would make the phase transition strongly first order. Okay? And we would like to know experimentally, can we get any evidence for the order of the phase transition as we go back in the early universe? Now, obviously we can't recreate the high temperature conditions of the early universe in very high energy collisions, but if there were new particles that affected the Higgs violently enough to change a smooth phase transition into a strongly first order one, they would first of all have to be not too heavy, right? These particles couldn't be at 5 TeV or so. They'd have to have a mass comparable to the mass of the Higgs in order to affect the nature of the phase transition, A. And B, they can't be too weakly coupled to the Higgs, because again, they wouldn't change the order of the phase transition. So if the phase transition was actually first order, strongly first order, rather than the smooth phase transition we predict in the standard model, that's only possible if you have light particles that are relatively strongly coupled to the Higgs. And that's perfect for exactly the machines that we're talking about. Okay? Because they're light and relatively strongly coupled to the Higgs, on the one hand, we expect them to change the detailed couplings of the Higgs to other particles. And on the other hand, the new particles that affect the phase transition have got to be light enough to be producible when you eventually go to 100 TeV collisions. Now, these are studies that people have been doing over the past year or two, detailed studies. If you take the sort of simplest way, absolute simplest way you might imagine of making the phase transition first order, okay? You have, for example, you have a new scalar that has a cubic interaction with the Higgs. Then that's something that gives you big effects. That's something you could see, like 10% level deviations in the coupling of the Higgses. The particles would be light enough you could see big new resonances in 100 TeV colliders again, but not at the LHC. And even if you work hard to make this physics hard to see, then at least the preliminary studies have shown that a big order one chunk of the parameter space of even the theories that you work to hide as much as possible will be covered by a combination of the measurements at a Higgs factory and at 100 TeV. A third aspect of this that I just want to emphasize is that, I should have said this perhaps at the very beginning, you might think, we've all seen this Mexican hat potential picture for spontaneous symmetry breaking associated with the Higgs. We always write this picture down. We say that m squared is less than zero, and we say that that's the picture for that's a picture for electroweak symmetry breaking. But what do we know experimentally? What do we know about this experimentally? We don't know this remotely experimentally from the LHC. All we've done, you know, for 50 years, we just knew there was something nailed there. And at the LHC, we just started seeing the small quadratic fluctuations around the bottom. So we have no idea what the global shape of this potential is, nor will we have an idea of the global shape of this potential is from the LHC. For all we know, it could be h to the fourth plus h to the sixth. Okay? Or it could be h to the fourth. It doesn't even have to look like a polynomial. It could be h to the fourth log h squared. Okay, so these are various pictures for, these are various pictures for what the potential could be. Now you might say, you're just being obstinate. You're being a lame-o. Okay? It's obvious that's the picture. Why are you, it's so blindingly obvious. Why would you think it's anything other than that? You're just doing a Taylor expansion, done, right? Why would you ever question that that's the picture? Well, in fact, where did this picture come from? It came to us courtesy of Landau and Ginzburg and the analogy with condensed matter physics. And indeed, if we follow the analogy with condensed matter physics perfectly, then we would expect that that's what the picture looks like. And we would have also expected that we shouldn't see something like the Higgs, or we should have seen tons of new physics come along with the Higgs. In other words, exactly the dimensional analysis arguments that lead us to believe that that's the picture are precisely the ones, literally one and the same ones, that led us into these mysteries associated with the existence of the Higgs in the first place. Okay. In other words, if this logic is so incontrovertible, then it's already been proven wrong. Okay? Because we should have seen a ton of other new particles coming along with the Higgs. Okay? So we need to check this logic experimentally. In fact, in a sense, we don't even know that we have this infamous hierarchy or fine-tuning problem. I didn't use those words yet. But we don't even know that we have those problems until we've confirmed that this picture is correct. This is not an innocuous assumption. Okay? The idea that the universe is very much like a dirty metal goes to the root of this analogy with the condensed matter physics. And what we might be seeing from the discovery of the Higgs is it's not like that. Okay? But we need to check if this is even true to begin with. All right. So what is the difference between this and this? What's the zeroth order difference between them? The zeroth order difference between them is that they predict different values for the at quadratic level they can look identical, but at cubic level they'll look different. For example, this predicts that this triple Higgs interaction is 50% different than it is here. Okay? But for that, we'll barely know at the LHC. So that's something which going to the 100 TeV collider and seeing whether this triple Higgs interaction is there and seeing whether it's compatible with the standard model is giving us evidence for this picture. All right. Since I'm out of time, let me just say a very quick thing about one of these two topics, so the one which is maybe not been beaten to death so much. I want to just say a few words about weakly interacting dark matter. So many of you have probably heard of WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. There's only one picture we've ever had for what dark matter is, where theorists could calculate it. It's abundance, right? The difficulty with dark matter is you can invent any particle that you like, give it any mass that you like, up to some experimental constraints, can't be too heavy, and can't be like a big Jupiter or something like that. But it could be a Winnebago even, okay? And you just adjust its number density until it's right, okay? In order to be able to remove this uncertainty about initial conditions, to be able to actually calculate how much dark matter you have, the only thing that we know how to do is to assume that it was once upon a time in thermal equilibrium with the rest of the standard model. And if we make that assumption that early in the history of the universe it was in equilibrium, then if we know the microphysics, if we specify the particle physics associated with this dark matter, then we can in principle compute how much of it is left over in exactly the same way that knowing nuclear physics we can compute the relic abundance of the light elements in Big Bang nuclear synthesis. Okay? And famously, for 30 years, people have known that if you ask what properties do you need for this particle, in order for it to be dark matter, it needs to be something that has a cross-section for annihilating the standard model particles of roughly the weak scale. Okay? So that's the so-called WIMP miracle. But in more detail, it turns out that this WIMP miracle certainly does not imply that dark matter should have been accessible to the LHC. In fact, if you ask, in other words, a particle of mass of order hundreds of GeV. See, the LHC is really good at making colored particles, strongly interacting particles with mass up to, let's say, 2 or 3 TeV, 2 or 3,000 GeV. But weakly interacting particles, because you're colliding protons and the strong interactions are stronger than everything else, the rate for producing weakly interacting particles is lower. And we have access for making them maybe about a factor of 5 smaller in energy than that, so maybe 300, 400 GeV. So if dark matter weighed 300 or 400 GeV, then you would have reasonably expected the LHC to be able to produce it. However, you could ask, what mass could we have a priori expected for dark matter? And if you take the very, very simplest theories for what weakly interacting dark matter could be, in fact, if the W in weakly interacting is literally the weak interactions, rather than some other hypothetical interaction that as theorists we enjoy making up all the time, which is qualitatively the same, but isn't literally actually the same. If the W in WIMP is weak, then there's fairly robust masses we should expect the dark matter particles to have. For example, if we just had a particle that was an electroweak doublet, like the leptons, and the neutral component of that guy was the dark matter, then it would have to have a mass of around 1 TeV in order for it to be dark matter from the early universe. If it was going to be an electroweak triplet, it would have to have a mass of 3 TeV in order to be dark matter. Not hundreds of GeV. Those particles are not being made copiously by the LHC. And in fact, you can ask, what do you need to do in order to be able to produce robustly, ignoring even the dark matter motivation, what do you have to do to robustly produce weakly interacting particles with a mass of order a few TeV? The answer is 100 TeV collider. And in the particular case of dark matter, the sort of process that you're interested in is where, from, let's say, quarks and anti-quarks, you can produce pairs of dark matter particles. And this we don't see. We can't see these invisible particles. But we can radiate extra gluons or other particles. And so you look for just a single particle and missing energy. And that's a probe for what the dark matter particles are, which, again, in these very simplest models of dark matter, very, very simplest models, going to 100 TeV collider is just about what you need in order to be able to cover robustly the parameter space associated with them. All right, so I don't have any time to talk about the motivation for naturalness. I'll just say that, roughly speaking, the energy reach of a 100 TeV collider, the mass reach is maybe 5 times higher than anything we can do at the LHC. And the probe, remember we have these Kmax squareds, these Kmax to the fourths in our estimates before. The probe of these vacuum quantum fluctuations scales as a square of the energy that you can reach. So a factor of 5 or 10 going to higher energies is getting us the square of that factor, 25 to 100, in our reach and our probe of these violent quantum mechanical fluctuations. So let me just end by coming back actually to this analogy with this analogy with the cosmological constant. We had really two huge discoveries in fundamental physics. Well, we had gravity waves very recently, which is extremely exciting as well. But we had two very big discoveries in fundamental physics in the last 20 years, the discovery of the accelerating universe and the discovery of the Higgs. They seem to be connected to each other. These problems and these phenomena are connected to each other. And in the case of the cosmological constant, our friends in astronomy have no difficulty making the argument that the cosmological constant is weird and strange and we should go study it and make sure it's really a constant. And even though theorists tell them, no, we know for a fact now, even though we're wrong before, we made all these predictions before, they're all wrong, now you should believe us. And it's not really that worth checking if W is E really equal to -1 exactly. No, it's a proper responsible thing to do is just go and measure it. Okay? The avatar of those problems in particle physics is these measurements of the Higgs, and it's a very rich experimental program, not just measuring one number. Okay, you have to measure lots and lots of things, but it's exactly the same set of intellectual problems, and exactly the same set of excusey words that you could make ahead of time, because roughly speaking, the same theorists who predicted that you would find a vanishing cosmological constant also predicted that the LHC would explode with superpartners when it turned on. Okay. So there's something that we don't understand as theorists about the quantum vacuum. Okay, there's something about the combination of space-time, quantum mechanics, and the vacuum that we don't understand. We need to study it in the sky. We need to study it on the Earth. And I think there's an extremely exciting experimental program for doing that in the next 20 or 30 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nima, I want to, for a change of pace, go back to a subtlety that you sort of glided over. Now, I know perfectly well that you understood it perfectly well, but I just want to make sure you don't confuse people. When you say 3 is not equal to 2,
yes.
That somehow you gave the impression that that implies the photon's massless.
No, right? I didn't mean to imply that it was massless. I thought I said it carefully and correctly.
Okay.
Which is that if one way or another, by hook or by crook, you get something that looks like a massless photon,
right.
Its existence is robust.
Right.
And as I said, in finesse matter systems, as you know better than me, you have to work to find the right system that has emergent gate.
Absolutely.
Field. But once you do, you can kick it, you can mess around with it, and you won't change the fact that it has the emergent gate.
Right. So 3 is actually equal to 2 plus 1, but the 1 is very, very weakly coupled.
Right.
Okay.
But you need to have the one lying around.
You have to have the one.
What about testing quantum mechanics itself? Will an accelerator at these energies help with that? Or do you think you have to get to the Planck scale?
Well, I mean, of course, any test you do at some zero order, anything we do when we go to these extreme conditions is testing everything about the basic structure of quantum field theory. If I had to design. If we had to guess where we might expect quantum mechanics to get fuzzy, numbers like either the area over G Newton would have to start showing up very likely. So we're very likely not going to be seen. On the other hand, I mean, I don't want to downplay it. This thing I said quickly, but I myself think it's glorious to actually see quantum field theory finally experimentally in the massless regime. We have not, we've in fact never seen this transition from massive to a massless perturbatively, and that's a huge opportunity for really seeing what the quantum theory wants to do.
Please. You mentioned that some theorists were saying that the LHC should explode the superpartners,
right.
But that depends which theorist you talk to.
Yes.
Like your thesis, didn't you do it on the flavor problem that's favored?
Oh, yeah, I was one of them.
10 to 100 PeV sparks. And
I was one of them, but in my defense, I was 25 years old. By the time I was 32, I wasn't saying it anymore.
Didn't your thesis favor very heavy?
Sorry?
Didn't your thesis favor very heavy, Susie?
Sorry. You're trying to give me more credit. Thank you. Yes. I knew it all along. Yes. In fairness, it's not. It's true. I don't want to make fun of all of my colleagues. I mean, there's some. This. It is not. But this is. Thank you. Let me just say it quickly. I want to dispel this idea because there is this thought out there which I actually helped propagate this myth. That all theorists thinking about physics beyond the standard model were absolutely convinced that when the LHC turns on, it would explode with superpartners, and then it didn't, and all of a sudden we're like, oh shit, oh my god, we're all wrong. In fact, it's not like that. Most of the people who thought deeply about this physics 10, 15, 20 years ago were already disturbed that supersymmetry, and by the way, supersymmetry is just a stand-in for any K-max mechanism, anything that made the Higgs composite, anything which solved this why is the Higgs point-like problem. That physics could have been showing up 20 years ago. It could have been showing up at the experiment at CERN before the LHC. The LOP experiment could have been showing up there. It could have shown up at Fermilab. So it was already disquieting to the people who thought about these things deeply in the early 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, getting more and more disquieting all the time that we hadn't seen anything. Okay. And so there's a subset of people who's not at all surprised about what's happened from the LHC so far. And in fact, roughly speaking, what's happened so far is not surprising. Not seeing anything through the end of run one is more or less what you'd expected if you took all the indirect hints from not seeing things before seriously. Okay? The run two is going to be qualitatively different. It'll force us experimentally, if we don't see anything, into territory that we weren't forced into.
from the indirect things beforehand. But it's by no means true that people who thought about these things deeply were shocked by the findings of the LHC. I certainly wasn't shocked. But the very fact that you have groups of people who've been thinking about one of the same problem for 30 years and having very different zero-order pictures for what the physics should look like should give you an indication of how confused we are as theorists. And we're not confused because we can't calculate something to the next decimal place. We're not confused about details. We're confused about big picture, zero-order things about the structure of quantum mechanics, space, time, and the vacuum. That's what we're confused about.
Perfect place to start.
Thank you.